Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast. I'm Sian Kane.
I'm Claire Armistead.
And I'm Richard Lee.
Now, we don't know where in the world you might be listening in from, and this perhaps isn't news for you, but where we are in North London, the sun is out. And that is reason enough for us to want to celebrate with a podcast about books that encourage us to look anew at nature. We're going to discover how you can find food growing wild, even in the city, as Richard tries to collect his own dinner with professional forager John Wright.
Yeah, with more or less success.
Just over there, there's a broom tree, a broom shrub.
It's another 10 yards on.
Yeah, you're okay. You're not tiring yourself out, are
I think I'll just about make it.
But first, Andrea Wolfe. You may recall Claire was in Cartagena at a branch of the Hay Literary Festival some weeks ago, and while she was there, she came across Wolfe talking about her new book, The Adventures of Alexander von Humboldt. So first, Claire, Wolfe will be appearing at festivals across the UK all summer. Why was it important to you to interview her on a bench in the centre of Cartagena?
Well, actually, the real story is actually weirder than that, which is that I was sent this fabulous book. It's a huge, great graphic biography of Alexander von Humboldt. And I was sent it at Christmas, and I leafed through it, and I saw it was set in South America, Latin America. So I took it with me in my suitcase, partly because they'd put out an appeal for books for local school kids. And I thought, oh, well, here's this lovely book. Perhaps I could pass it on to local school kids. And also it gives me something lovely to read while I'm there. And when I got there, I found not only was Andrea there, but the book wasn't. Really, because it had been published to date in such a minute number of copies that actually what I was holding was pretty much gold. So everybody in the festival wanted it. So I clung onto it and brought it back in my suitcase. And I thought it was too good an opportunity to miss to actually meet Andrea in Cartagena, because there is a scene in this book which involves von Humboldt going there.
And her book, The Invention of Nature, won her the Wellcome Prize a few years back, and that was also about von Humboldt. So why did she sort of decide that she needed to come back and sort of revisit him?
Well, this is a very different sort of thing. I mean, that was a serious biography. And this is a really magical opening him up to a different generation, but also opening him up to different sorts of readers. He's a fascinating figure. He was a Prussian aristocrat who decided to go off and become an explorer. And in doing so, he was the first person to realise that actually everything was joined up in nature. So he was looking at geology, at botany, at climatology, at astrology. And through his travels, he did things like when he went up the Andes, he realised that the ecosystems in the Andes were similar to ecosystems in Switzerland. Hmm. And what this book does is she's working with a very brilliant young designer, and they incorporate, he also was an incredibly prolific letter writer. There are something like 50,000 letters he wrote, and he then also obviously received letters in return. And so she's used sort of archival materials and lots of period illustrations and drawn them into this book. So it actually gives you the texture of the sort of the way that they were thinking and the way that they were representing nature as they go, as you read through the book. So it is a brilliant way of representing exploration and discovery in a period that is now quite distant to us.
But it's a very modern way of thinking about the natural world. Yeah. It's all interconnected, as we're discovering to our cost.
Now we know that. But, but you know, that this was not known at that time. And he was actually, by his contemporaries, described at the time as the most famous person after Napoleon. And he was, I mean, he really was really famous. And he was really influential on Darwin. He was very influential on Wordsworth and Coleridge, on the whole Romantic movement. And at the moment, one of the fascinating things is this book has been top of the German charts because he's a massive hero to the Germans. But as Andrea says, he's not really very well known here, not as well known as Darwin. He's not as well known as he should be. So she's part of her mission, although I think she's probably a bit tiring of this mission now, is to actually say, look, guys, there's this really, really important figure. Look what he did. And this is where the idea of joined up thinking goes. It's where the whole idea of climatic catastrophe goes back to as well. And of course, Cartagena is full of nature, even in the middle of the town. And what you can hear in the background are grackles. As I discovered, they're big blackbirds, a bit like a cross between a blackbird and a crow or a magpie without the white bits. And I asked her to describe in her own terms how the adventures differed from the invention of nature.
Well, it's kind of a graphic novel, although novel implies kind of fiction. So this is very much a graphic non-fiction book, I suppose. So it's a book where we try to show Humboldt's artistic side. So Humboldt was an explorer. He was the most famous scientist of his age, but he was also very artistic. And the reason why I wanted to do a book showing his artistic side is when I saw his actual manuscripts while I was doing the research for The Invention of Nature. I saw his diaries, 4,000 pages kind of tightly written in his quite indecipherable handwriting, but also hundreds and hundreds of drawings of monkeys and fish from the Orinoco and profiles of volcanoes and mine shafts and calculations and maps of rivers. And it was so visual and so extraordinary, and it was such a... How shall I explain? So he writes... And he writes on little bits of paper, and then he puts them on top of each other. So he creates these multi-layered collages of thoughts. So I wanted to do a book with someone else, because I'm not very artistic, which shows this. So I found this extraordinary illustrator, Lillian Melcher, who was based in New York when I met her, 23 years straight out of art school. And we sat together and created a book that... So we wanted to create something that used a lot of his original materials, his notes, his diaries, but also his plant material, his dried herbarium specimen. So basically, just going right back to the beginning, just for people who don't know the story of Alexander von Humboldt, he was a Prussian. He did everything, polymath, wasn't he? But who set off for South America in 1799, having got permission from the King of Spain. Nobody was allowed to go there, wasn't Spanish. Yeah, it was very unusual that he got the permission to do this. So he went on this five-year exploration of South America. And what's so important about him is he returned from this exploration with a completely new view of nature, a new concept of nature, where he describes nature as a living organism, as a interconnected whole where everything belonged together, from the smallest insect to the tallest trees and volcanoes. So this new book, The Adventures of Alexander von Humboldt, tells the story of those 5 years. Rather, in The Invention of Nature, I tell the story of Humboldt's whole life. So this is concentrating just on his adventures, really. So this page here is from his journey along the Orinoco.
And it's got great big illustrations of fishes. Are those his fishes?
Yes.
Fishes with whiskers. And
So the entire river is made out of his diary pages, his writing, but also the fish they caught and dissected. We have drone footage of the Amazon, so like collage photographs of treetops. We have Lillian's drawings of the boat capsizing in the Orinoco. So they almost drown here in this scene. And then, and this is my favorite bit really, is when I read his diaries, there's a page which has big dark watermarks on them. And he describes in a note in his diaries, these are the watermarks that happened when my diary got wet, when we almost drowned in the Orinoco. And Lillian has him jumping into the Orinoco through his watermarks. So he's rescuing his diary on the actual page of his diary through the watermark.
And then there's another page where he travels with a French botanist, and there's a time when they're travelling across the Caribbean Sea, and all his work gets mouldy. And you've managed to recreate the mould.
So the Lillian and I were really perfect match, I think. We're both incredibly nerdy about historical facts. So we wanted everything to be as authentic as possible. So what she suggested and what she did is she wanted to show these mouldy pages because it was very hot and humid. So Bonpland, the botanist, he was constantly struggling to dry his plants. She said, I need to have some plants to make them mouldy. But she lived in New York, and this was the middle of winter, so where to get tropical plants in the middle of winter in New York? So I know some people from the New York Botanical Garden who very kindly gave us some cuttings from their South American collection, which Lillian then sprinkled with milk and tea and coffee, all in a very unscientific way, and then shoved them in her garden shed for a few weeks. And then, voila, she creates some mold and then scans it in, which is now in our book here. So it was all very much... It's very tactile and visceral almost, I think. And I thought when I did The Invention of Nature, because I'd done so much research that I'm completely, you know, I've done all the research, there's nothing more to do. But then Lillian suddenly wanted to know, you know, how was he holding his scientific instruments? Because in The Invention of Nature, I could say like, oh, he took his barometer, went up the mountain and measured the height of the mountain. But she needed to draw it. So I know someone who is an expert in historical scientific instruments, so he sent us photos step by step using a dip needle, a barometer, so that she could draw it.
And it meant that they basically had to transport this barometer horizontally across mountains. You're talking about carrying a glass object across mountains without actually losing its horizontality.
And the amazing thing about this story is that he had a servant whose main job was actually to carry the barometer, because it was the most important scientific instrument for the whole expedition.
So you have pictures of them going across a mountain with this huge great tube held sideways rather than up and down. No slinging it easily across his shoulders.
No.
There's also another lovely one of the movement of the Southern Cross during the time that he made one particular journey. Tell us about that.
So he travels from, on this expedition, at some stage he travels from Ecuador to Acapulco, Mexico, and he describes his sadness of seeing the star constellation of the Southern Cross slowly dipping towards the horizon. The more north he goes, kind of it slowly disappears. And in order for Lillian to draw this, we wanted to make sure that she draws the constellation correctly. So I'd written a book about astronomy, it's kind of called Chasing Venus, a few years ago. So I knew an astronomer, so we asked him, and he sent us these drawings where of the constellation, how it changed exactly in that year, in 1803, along the route that Humboldt was taking. So these are kind of little things which probably no one will notice, but it was very satisfying.
So what you've got is a picture of a boat going across a page, and then you've got the constellation in three different places.
Sinking slowly
during their voyage. So what I'm absolutely fascinated about with this book is this huge, very scientifically correct subtext that's going on, if you care to know about it. It's got three dimensions that you don't necessarily see as a casual reader.
Which is exactly what Humboldt did with his books, and I think this is why we started thinking along these lines. So Humboldt is a scientist who, on the one hand, schleps 42 scientific instruments across Latin America, but at the same time, he says, we have to use our imagination to understand nature. So he writes these books, which, for the general audience, which are quite poetic. I mean, there's no other scientist at that time who would write like this. But at the same time, he has these scientific endnotes, which, if you so choose to, if you are so inclined to, you will get the latest scientific knowledge in those endnotes. But you don't have to read them. You can just go along with a more poetic landscape description. And in a way, that's what we are trying to do here. So on the one hand, you can just read this as a great adventure story of Humboldt traveling through South America. But you do it along his manuscript. So you can dip kind of much deeper if you want to. And we decided to do one thing where we have him walking through his own manuscripts and through his own engraving. So there's another page, which is one of my favorite pages, which is an engraving of the profile of the mountains from Acapulco to Mexico City. And he describes how their collections by now have increased so much that they need 21 mules to carry them from the boat to Mexico City. So we have him and his little small team walking along his own drawing with the 21 mules. So it was just great fun to kind of put him into his own drawings, kind of climbing up mountains he climbed, but these are his drawings.
It takes a certain sort of obsessiveness to do that, I think. So why are we interested in Humboldt? Why should we read about Humboldt today?
Well, I think he's still incredibly important. He gave us a concept of nature that still very much shapes our thinking today. He was such a polymath and so interdisciplinary that he brought together the arts and the sciences, for example, in a way that I think is very, very important today. So we have, look at the political debates around kind of the environment. These are debates where we are kind of facing numbers, statistics, careful legal wording. This and this is going to happen if this and this increases. And nothing of that speaks to your heart or to your soul. And I'm really missing this admission that we might have to also talk about the wonder of nature, our love to nature. And that's something which Humboldt does. So on the one hand, he's this obsessive scientist who measures all the time, but he's also completely unafraid of talking about the poetry of nature. And I think that's something that's absolutely missing in today's debates on climate change. So in that respect, I think he's very important.
He also actually was the person who formulated the thinking about nature actually being in the perpetual battle with itself, wasn't it? Rather, he said he disagreed with Newton.
Yes, so in that respect, he's very important for Charles Darwin and Darwin's kind of evolutionary theory. But I think what's very important about Humboldt today is that he talks about that humankind can destroy nature. So by seeing nature as a living organism, he also realizes that we have an impact of nature. And he talks about harmful human-induced climate change in 1800.
Such as indigo being very damaging to the environment, intensive indigo farming. Well, who would have thought that in the early 19th century that would have been on people's minds?
So as he travels through South America, he notes again and again and again, for example, how pearl fishing has completely destroyed the oyster stocks. In Mexico City, he talks about the local irrigation system that has left the surrounding valleys completely barren. And he says humankind is raping nature. So he's really not holding back at all. There's a moment in his diary in 1801 where he talks about a possible future where we might travel to distant planets. And then he says, if we do that, we will take our lethal mixture of greed and arrogance and violence with us, and we will leave these planets as barren as we've done already with Earth.
So coming back to where we started, we're doing this interview in Cartagena, and there is another reason for it, which is that your work is huge in South America, isn't it, because of him being here. And it's where he's really well known is in Germany and where he came from, and here, which is where he did most of his work.
When I started working on Humboldt, people would just go to me like, who is he? I've never heard of him. So he's almost forgotten in the English-speaking world. He's not forgotten at all in South America. In Latin America, he's a huge hero. Almost every school child. You know, there are like lots of schools here called the Humboldt schools. There are monuments, there are mountains named after him because of his friendship with Simon Bolivar. And because he traveled through South America, and he really put this continent on the map in a way. So I've been first coming to South America for the research of this, of the invention of nature, and then became quite addicted following Humboldt's footsteps, because it's a beautiful, beautiful continent. So I take any opportunity at the moment, any literary festival, to come to South America, because I don't know how other writers do it, but I need to see the landscapes of the people I write about. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense. So I needed to go to the Orinoco, I needed to go to the Andes, I needed to see these places that were so important for Humboldt's vision of nature, for Humboldt's concept of nature.
So we're sitting here in this great big public square, which is not actually, it's called a park, but it's actually paved. And there's a dome of the cathedral in front of us, and there's sort of various bits of traffic and lots of birds, which I have discovered have been called grackles, which he undoubtedly would have seen and heard. And he would recognise the trees around us, would he?
Yes, I mean he was a very good botanist. Although he had Bonpland as a botanist with him, Humboldt was also very good with botany. But he kind of gave the botany to Bonpland, and he did everything else basically. But they came back with 60,000 dried plant specimens, 6,000 species, of which more than half were new to European botanists. So huge numbers.
And just one last thing, which is I love the eel experiment. And this is it's something that they did that was only actually finally proved to actually be true and not fantasy in 2016 or something. Tell us about the eel.
So when Humboldt travels through Venezuela, through the Llanos, the great plains of Venezuela, he hears that there are electric eels. A very strange fish, about 5 foot long, and they can discharge electric shocks of around 600 volt. And he was very, very keen to dissect one. But of course, you can't just catch it because then you would be dead immediately. But the locals had an idea. They lived in the bottom of shallow ponds. So the locals drove a herd of 30 wild horses into the pond, and the hooves of the horses churned up the mud, and then the eels, the electric eels, were kind of coming out. And it was a pretty gruesome spectacle because you have the eels kind of thrashing against the belly of the horses, and eventually they discharge their electricity and become very weak. So then you can catch them and you can kind of dissect them. And Humboldt describes this in one of his books. And until 2016, most people said that he just completely made the story up, that the eels would attack a horse. And then in 2016, a scientist in Nashville kind of proved that he was right. So we have, in the graphic novel, we kind of show this, but we also have the original, the headlines from the 2016 story in there. So we almost bring this story to an end, but told through Humboldt's story.
So the lovely thing about that is this book contains stuff that didn't exist. I mean, proper scientific evidence that didn't exist at the time that you wrote The Invention of Nature, which was the source material for this book. There's something really lovely about that. So your work on Humboldt is continuing evolution.
Yes, well, what happened actually was that while I was writing The Invention of Nature, or when I was coming towards the end of writing The Invention of Nature, his diaries, which had been in private hands, were bought in Germany by an archive in Berlin. It was too late to use that in The Invention of Nature, which wasn't a problem in terms of content because we had transcriptions of the diaries, but it was actually seeing them that made me think I need to do a little bit more here. And it was never going to be something that could be in The Invention of Nature because that's not an illustrated book. It was so much fun looking at him again through a kind of visual lens, I think. And it's something that also came through. I did so many talks about The Invention of Nature, and I realized that one of the things that people love about Humboldt is that he so easily weaves together the arts and the sciences, because we tend to draw such a sharp line between the objective and the subjective, and he so easily kind of puts it together. So in a way, this book was almost like a homage to Humboldt, and it's his 250th birthday this year, so it kind of felt like a fitting last book about Humboldt, and then I will move on to something else.
That was Andrea Wolf there speaking in Cartagena. Nonfiction graphic novels, even though you might think that novel and nonfiction might contradict each other, it's not really a new thing, is it?
No, not at all, but I think that's kind of part of the source of the confusion, but some people don't expect to find nonfiction in a kind of graphical form. And I think the graphic novel is called a graphic novel to distinguish it from a short comic, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a bigger thing. But what do you call something that's nonfiction but is still graphic? I mean, you know, you couldn't call it a graphic biography, could you? Otherwise,
no, it sounds very rude. But, I mean, you know, back in 2012, which is quite recent history in terms of the graphic biography, if we may call it, Brian and Mary Talbot won the Costa Biography Prize with Daughter of Her Father's Eyes, which combined a biography of Lucia Joyce, who's James Joyce's daughter, with an autobiography of Mary Talbot, who's the daughter of a great Joyce scholar. So, you know, it's really not a new thing. But I do think that there is something going on about the reclamation of images for adults. And I know there's always been a comic culture, a sort of cult comic culture, but the thing about a very serious book that can also be very beautiful.
Mm.
And it's the intertextuality, to use the posh word for it, between pictures and text. It's sort of having a bit of a renaissance. And I think you see that in this book. Very, very high production standards as well. So it ties in as well with the renaissance of the idea of the beautiful book that cannot be replicated online.
And also, like, geek culture as well is really headed into the mainstream at the moment, as we've seen with loads of things, including everything that's in pop culture at the moment that seems to be science fiction and fantasy based. But also comics as well have sort of had a little bit of an upswing.
Yeah, so I suppose it's tropes that are changing from sort of minority things or geek culture, as you say, into the mainstream is embracing new ways of telling stories.
Mm. Yeah, it's just the rise of the visual, isn't it? We're all watching telly, we're all on our smartphones. Why not have books with pictures in
it? Yeah, yeah, and that's a really good point, actually, because we all think of everything as moving inexorably towards television, the moving image, but actually books are reclaiming, and in doing so sort of actually regenerating themselves, saying, hey, look at us guys, there are things we can do that the moving image can't do.
Well, if the sound of grackles cawing didn't make you want to go outside straight away, then John Wright will. We'll go foraging in nature's wild harvests after this.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
It's not the first thing I'd think of doing while walking around London, but foraging is a thing, inverted commas, and a growing trend. John Wright has been doing this for years and has published The Forager's Calendar, a book describing the hows, whys, and crucially, the whens for foraging. So Richard, what exactly is foraging?
Well, it's looking for food in the wild, isn't it? But crucially, it's kind of different way of looking at the natural world, looking at it with something of an acquisitive eye. I mean, it's something that's always been part of rural life, particularly on the continent. And it's also a way of returning to a sort of older mode of existence. I mean, I think people always used to find food in the hedgerows and bushes. You know, it's almost going back beyond a world of ready meals and supermarkets, and even beyond a world of farming and industry. Mm. It's a natural way of being.
But in the cities, it's quite interesting. I've got a problem with wild onions in my garden. Mm. And I sometimes think they're foraging me rather than I'm foraging them. They're literally growing up between my flagstones and the advance of the wild onions. And
but that's the thing. I mean, even in the city, with all our concrete and flagstones and everything, we're still part of the natural world.
So what was it like, Richard? What was your afternoon with John like? Was it how you expected?
Sort of yes and sort of no. I mean, it's kind of foraging, as I say, it's a very natural thing to do. I remember as a kid returning from a country walk with blackberries in pots or whatever we had to hand, or going out and looking for other things in the hedgerows. But was very surprised by what happened with John, because I was surprised at how little actual walking took place. I mean, we would stop every few steps and he'd say, oh, there's something interesting. Oh, that's quite... We could have a bit of that. We'd try that. And when we met at the Hackney Marshes Sports Centre, in East London, we almost didn't get as far as getting out the car park because he'd spotted something straight away. I mean, the weather was a little greyer on that day, a breeze from the north with the occasional shower of rain. So I started by asking for a little reassurance.
So, John, are you confident we're going to find something delicious?
I'm absolutely positive we can. I'm not sure we're going to have enough to feed ourselves for supper tonight, but we'll get some interesting tastes, some interesting flavours and some pretty plants.
We're here in spring, despite the grey weather, but what kind of thing do you think we're on the lookout here?
Well, spring is the time when things are very green, and that's, so it's salad days, I suppose you could say. For something more substantial, you really need the autumn where you get the mushrooms and the nuts and the berries. But I tell you what you do get now is that some really nice flowers, and actually there's something really rather good just where we're standing. You didn't think there was anything here, did you? But there's we're standing under really a rather splendid tree. It's a large shrub, and it's a glorious, wonderful elder, the elderflower.
The elderflower's out already?
It is. I usually wait until the 1st of June. I think of it as a summer plant. And for years it was coming out in 1st of June. It was the first chance to get a sniff of it. But the last couple of years it's been coming out in May and even in April. But, of course, it's nice and warm here in the Hackney Marshes. Well, not today it isn't, but usually it is. So that brings things forward.
So, shall we harvest some of this elderflower, or shall we go straight on?
I think we should at least have a sniff. I was going to grab one off of here. I can break it off between two leaves, and there we go. This is actually my first sniff of the year of elderflower. Oh, it's absolutely glorious. Indescribable. If you haven't smelt it, you really should, but I can't describe it to you. It's rather a fruity smell.
You can almost feel the berries on the way.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can't pick flowers and berries, so rather a heady, fruity smell. Useful, of course, in cordial. It makes the most wonderful cordial, which is ridiculously expensive in the shop, and you make it for next to nothing yourself.
But we're talking shopping bags full rather than handfuls.
Yeah, I think a shopping bag full of elderflowers would make you half a dozen bottles of cordial. Yeah, that'll work.
Fantastic. So where to next?
We don't have to go very far. The smell of these elderflowers has been almost overwhelmed by another plant. Fortunately, there's not much you can get from it, but it's a lovely plant, another tree, a common hedgerow tree, and found all sorts of places. Let's going to wander over here. We're actually surrounded by stuff. I've never been here before, and we've just stepped in here, and we walked about 10 yards, I suppose. And
15 paces.
15, okay. Oh, you're counting. this is a plant here. This is a tree. It's all trees at the moment, but this is actually a big tree. This is a lime. I think it's a small leaf lime. I think you ought to grab some of that. I'll give you a little bit and have a chew.
Have a munch?
Yeah, okay.
Very green.
It's a green flavour, yeah. Mm. It doesn't taste very much. It doesn't even taste particularly nice. It is rather neutral. There is a fundamental rule in foraging, indeed, just being human. Food doesn't have to taste nice. It just has to be nutritious. In fact, the definition of food is any plant material, or any organic material that it doesn't actually kill you. So that's the food.
So that's the level we're at here with the lime tree?
A bit, but it's, a few in the salad. And, what better to improve your hedge cred than serving a few lime leaves? This is nothing to do with oranges and lemons and limes. This is the lime tree, linden tree. Yeah, you serve some of that. So I've scattered it with some local lime leaves. Showing. I'm a terrible one for showing off and doing silly things like that. Obviously, we walked past something. I nearly jumped and grabbed you to look at that. But let's go back.
Let's go back. What have we got here? On the ground this time?
Yeah, this is on the ground. This is rather a busy corner of Hackney Marshes. Not a sort of place I would want to forage anything on the ground. There are sort of canines around a little bit. And also it's a little patch, or I suppose about 5 foot square here of this plant. It's called Fat Hen, and it is a plant which is famous for growing in nitrogen-rich areas. I think you can see the connection I have with nitrogen-rich areas and dogs.
Yeah, spell it out for us.
Yeah, I think something... It may not have happened. It just grows on bare ground. But I wouldn't really want to pick it. You have to be a little bit sensible about these things.
And what's the sort of legal situation? Is it all right to just pick a bit of chickweed or some fat hen that you see when you're out on a walk?
Yes. We are lucky, only just, but we are lucky in the fact that there is a long-standing right to forage. And this has been enshrined in the 1968 Theft Act, and it says, he who picks fruit, flower, fungi or foliage...
The four Fs.
The four Fs. from any land, provided it is growing wild and is for personal use, does not steal what he picks. And he does say any land. In fact, there are a few bits of land, especially in London, where you can't pick, like the Royal Parks. But I think we're okay in Hackney Marshes. Actually, even if you're trespassing, and you shouldn't be trespassing, if you went to a farmer's field and you saw some mushrooms there, and you picked them, and the farmer come along and say, "Hey, what do you think you're doing picking my mushrooms?" And he can tell you to leave. But he can't take the mushrooms off of you because you've picked them and they're yours now. I never met this guy, but a friend of mine knew him. He lived in the village down the road. Old Dick, I think his name was. But this is a Dorset farmhand. Must be, I think he'd be 120 by now if he was still alive. But he was in a farmer's field and the farmer came up to him and said, hey, Dick, what do you think you'll be doing? He said, "So you're picking my mushrooms." He said, "See, they'd not be your mushrooms, they'd be God's." And that was, a folk memory of how the natural world was ordered. You know, there was stuff that was farmed, and everything else was God's and Dick's, evidently.
So where to next?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a foray is not a walk, you see. A foray may involve a walk, but it's not necessarily a walk. And people get confused. I've just seen something. People get confused. And I take about 50 forays a year. I've done about 800 over the years. And we start and I say, okay, well let's start looking. And people just disappear off into the distance, and I have to say, come back. Where are you going? I said, we're already here. I'm going to say this to you, Richard, as well. We are already here. But just over there, there's a broom tree, a broom shrub.
It's another 10 yards on.
Yeah, you're okay. You're not tiring yourself out, Al.
I think I'll just about make it. So have you always foraged for food?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a full-time occupation, never has been. There will be. I think it's something that everybody can do. You know, if they're physically able, they can do this. And it's nice to just do it every now and then. It's a way of, you know, sorry, hackneyed. How appropriate. Hackneyed phrase, but it does get you back a little bit closer to our origins. We are natural foragers, a walk is a complete waste of time if you don't do a foray. You slow yourself down, you're looking about, and you start to see things. You start to see the natural world. If you just go for a walk, people just look at the view and think how lovely it is, and I'm sure it is a lovely view, but I try to look a little bit more closely at the natural world, and you see loads of things. Oh, so much to see.
Terrific. So should we pursue a little further?
Yeah, let's go. I don't know where to go. Just wander at random. That's sort of a foraging. I used to take these people out from sort of bushcraft people. One of these guys, he was a tracker, and we were on a mushroom foray once. And he told me at the end of the day I was the hardest person he ever met for tracking, because there was no sense in where I was going.
Peering down by the banks now. What are you looking for by a riverbank?
Well, there's lots. Oh, that's interesting. There's lots of. Oh, something else interesting. Oh, well, there's lots of interesting things down here. It's quite a steep bank. Did you bring any rope?
Yeah, I haven't got a rope or a ladder, I'm afraid.
No, or a machete. You forgot the machete too, didn't you? Okay, well, we just have to do it very carefully. I so want to get down, and you can actually see this plant from here. Can you see the one right by on the water's edge? that it's worth knowing because not everything in the garden or indeed in the wild is rosy. And that's hemlock water dropwort. That's a very nasty plant indeed. It looks, I'm sure you can see, it looks very much like flat-leaf parsley.
I was going to say that looks a bit like parsley.
It does, and it's in the carrot family along with parsley and carrots and stuff. The whole plant is deadly poisonous, the roots particularly so. They look very tasty, and I've dug them up, and they do look like very attractive bunches of carrots, except they're white, not orange. Then people have eaten them by mistake and basically got three very unpleasant hours to look forward to, and that's it. So it's a nasty, nasty plant, but beautiful.
So how different would this be if we were doing this foray in the country rather than the city?
Well, it's surprisingly similar. You know, the parks can be wonderful places to find wild food, especially mushrooms if you get the right park. But most parks will have a lot of non-native species. You know, parks are often partly garden, and they can be invasive. But this is surprisingly close to a natural environment. We're getting nearly all native plants here, so really almost indistinguishable from the countryside. So well done, Hackney Marshes.
So, I mean, you mentioned the idea that you need to show self-restraint. There's a kind of ethical dimension to it as well. What gives you the right to grab part of nature's bounty, part of our common wealth, and declare that it's yours, it's for your frying pan?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't like people who answer questions by asking, what gives you the right to eat anything? Because every time you eat something, you've taken something from somewhere else. I do think we do have a right. Do we have a right to food? Yes, I would say. I mean, this whole idea of the world being ours, I guess it's just a little bit arrogant, but you know, we are a species like any other. We are rather boorish in our nature. We need to moderate our worst instincts, I suppose. But yeah, we do have the same rights as any other species, but we have to remember that they have them too.
Has foraging changed since you've been doing it over the last 10, 15 years?
Yes, I suppose, you know, since when I was really seriously taking interest in fungi in the late 70s, everybody thought I was completely insane. Why are you picking these things? Why are you eating things? You know, you're going to die, John. You're going to die. But now it's normal. I say normal, but it's something that a lot of people do.
So for today, we've got ourselves a small salad with some elderflower cordial to finish.
Yes. We could have a chickweed. Chickweed pakora. We could put the fat hen in the chickweed pakora. So chickweed and fat hen pakora. That's going to be really good for us. Yeah, I think we've done well.
Richard, you were very polite about the treasures, inverted commas again, that you found. but would you do it again?
Well, I don't think I'll be organising expeditions to go out and harvest the elderflower or the chickweed or the fat hen, even come to that. And you have to be a little bit careful. I mean, I wouldn't be confident identifying mushrooms without an expert to hand, and you can, you know, pick up things which will really do you damage. But I mean, there's a question of awareness. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's also a question of additions as well. We tried the leaves of a lime tree. I didn't know you could eat the leaves of a lime tree at all. Turns out they're very green in spring. They taste kind of fresh. And we also found the flowers on a broom tree, which are kind of very pea-ish. And so it's not a question of going out that I'm going to go out and get a kilo of lime leaves and eat those. But you can imagine walking past a lime tree, and instead of just thinking, oh, that looks nice, you might gather a few and add them to your salad or something.
Well, John writes, The Forager's Calendar is published by Profile Books, and Andrea Wolfe's The Adventures of Alexander von Humboldt with illustrations by Lillian Melcher is with John Murray. Both are out now. And Andrea will be at the Hay Festival on Saturday, June 1st, where, incidentally, there will also be loads of foraging workshops going on, especially for kids. Next week, we look quite literally under the carpets with Sarah Krasnostein, who talks about her experiences following a trauma cleaner in Australia. And we time travel with novelist Sandra Newman and her new book, The Heavens.
And as always, do contact us on Twitter at Guardian Books or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. And do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
But for now, from me, Sian Kane.
And me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.